are Black. So trying to find a mental health service provider who looks like us, that is very, very difficult.
Women are also urged to contact their doctors, activate their personal support network, and find out if their company offers an employee assistance program that includes mental health resources. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 30th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes myself, my co-anchor Josh Salem, Zachary Jones-Nure, and David Rosenberg. The producers tonight are also myself and Althea Billings. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Suzanne Potter, Mike Moen, Nadia Romlagon, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The engineer for tonight's show and the director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eliza Yurkov.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned for KBOO News in Depth. We're going to be speaking with the organizers of the Portland Women's Strike. Stick with us.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Eliza Yurkov. This Friday, October 4th, at noon at Pioneer Courthouse Square, activists will gather for the Portland Women's Strike. Here to talk with us more about it, it's Michelle Daly. Welcome to the show, Michelle.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for being here. Can you tell us about how the women's strike got started? This isn't the first rally that you've organized.
Sure. Yeah, no, absolutely. This is our second one. So our group actually got started back in April, and it was started by a 24-year-old woman on TikTok in Chicago with the upcoming anniversary of overturning of Roe v. Wade. And this young woman had just had enough and went to social media and was able to organize 140 cities across the country and Canada that day. So here in Portland, we had about 300 people line the Burnside Bridge. We had signs, cars driving by, honking in support. It was a lot of fun, a lot of really great energy. So we are doing another one this Friday from 12 to 2 at Pioneer Courthouse Square. We are talking all about women's reproductive rights. We are talking about women's equality, trans women's health care rights, and an end to gender-based violence as well. So, you know, all around female equality. And so we'll be gathering, we'll be having a rally. We've got some speakers coming, we've got a DJ coming, and then we will be doing some marching with our signs and our bullhorns and a good old-fashioned march to raise our voices about these important matters.
That's excellent. Tell us a little bit more about who will be speaking.
Okay, sure. Yeah. So we do have Dr. Julia Tassett, who is a doctor at OHSU. And she came to OHSU to actually study all of the different abortion practices that are required for a doctor that are hard to actually learn at a lot of other medical schools in the country. And so she will be speaking, obviously, with a great point of view. Then we've got a slam poet coming, Jane Ischel, so that will be great to hear her views on everything going on. And then for local candidates, we have Commissioner Rubio, who will be speaking, and then the people running for City Council, Angelita Murillo, and also Candace Avalos. So we've got a whole lineup of, you know, different strong, powerful women who are coming to raise their voices and get all of us excited. And obviously, we're just wanting to really send the message that people need to be out voting in November.
Absolutely. Who is this event for? Who do you want to show up and participate on Friday?
Great question. This event is for everyone. While it is definitely called the Women's Strike, it is not just for women. At our last strike, it was great. We had all ages. We had kids in strollers. We had little kids making their own signs. We had a gentleman with a walker, a woman in a wheelchair. So it is certainly for everyone. Children are certainly welcome to come. It's a great time to show them what activism looks like. And then also men. We've got men volunteers coming. I don't have any of them speaking to us, but I didn't need any mansplaining that day, right? But no, we do have a lot of male supporters. We've been going out to street fairs and just talking to people in the community and finding great support from everyone. So I think it's an important issue that, you know, not just only females of reproductive years are concerned about, but it really is important to all of us.
Right. Reproductive rights are in every person's issue.
Absolutely.
For sure. In doing this kind of work, what kind of misconceptions do you usually encounter?
Well, I would say in Portland, we're pretty lucky living here in a bubble. We haven't run into too many people that oppose us or give us, you know, too hard of a time. But certainly we do run into the people who, for religious reasons, you know, are opposed to abortion, which I totally understand. And, you know, we tell those people, we're not here supporting abortion. We're here supporting a woman's right to choose and saying that it is her right and not the government's right. So, you know, if abortion does not work for you in your religious views, don't have one. But please, you know, let the woman next door decide for herself.
Right. So. Right. If our listeners are interested in learning more about this event, where should they go?
So we are on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok, and it's all at Women's Strike PDX, where they can find us, and they can find all of our event information. We've got a link tree there where they can find our email. They can purchase some t-shirts from us. We've got some fun t-shirts. Our tagline this year is Volva la Revolucion. So, we're having some fun while we're doing this as well. So they can certainly find all that information on our social media.
That's excellent. I remember in 2016, there was a women's march. Mm-hmm. Are you guys connected at all?
We're not. They are actually a different organization. They are a full-fledged nonprofit, and we are definitely just a grassroots movement. We did work with the Women's March people when we had our first rally, our first strike on June 24th. Because most of the people who were organizers had never done anything like this before. And so Women's March was great, and they had some trainings for us and, you know, tried to help us organize, because we are obviously fighting the same battle, just different organizations doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Since you said that the organization started last year and it was throughout the country, mm-hmm. in Canada, How are y'all connected? Do you connect? Is this strike happening all throughout the country on Friday?
So there are other cities happening on Friday. We know North Carolina has a huge presence, and that is obviously a very important state. Orlando has a huge presence. And so there are definitely strikes happening in other cities. And so people can look online, you know, for social media and see what's happening in their own city. But again, we, so grassroots, it is, you know, some TikTok messages, a few text messages. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, each city is really able to kind of look at what their city needs and how we can reach that group. And so every city is a little bit different, which I think is important. Mm-hmm. You know, we think that here in Portland, we're safe and we're in a bubble. But in November, things could change. So, you know, not only do we want to make sure everyone knows it's important to vote in November, but also show support to other people in other states where their rights aren't protected like ours here in Oregon.
Absolutely. Just because we're protected doesn't mean that other people are.
Right.
And it's important to remember that.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. This might be out of your depth, but how has Hurricane Helene affected North Carolina and Orlando?
To be honest, I have not talked to those women since that has happened. I do not know. Yeah. I did see that they posted in North Carolina today that they were still planning on moving forward, but I have not heard from the ladies in Orlando.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a devastating thing. So I hope that they can move forward. What inspired you to get involved in this movement?
Well, I think that after the Dobbs decision, or when they overturned Roe v. Wade, it just really infuriated me. I mean, I am past reproductive years, so it's not like I personally am going to be needing any of those services. But I'm just really tired of people trying to put their bans on me and on my body.
Yeah.
You know, we have been fighting and fighting and fighting, not just for reproductive rights, but just equality in general.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that once that decision came down, I personally had just had enough.
Yeah.
And need to stand up. I have a daughter, a young daughter. You know, I am worried about my neighbor's daughters. So I just decided that it was something that I've been passionate about. And when I saw on TikTok that they were starting these strikes, I thought, oh, Portland will have one for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't.
Hmm.
And so I said, well, I maybe should do that. And I've agreed kind of with 31 days to plan the last event. So not very long.
Not at all.
And fortunately, someone else in Portland had expressed interest. And so I had a co-coordinator to help me with all of this. And she and I have just sort of, you know, muddled through this and found really great support. But we're having a hard time reaching everyone, mm-hmm. obviously. And so that's why we're out doing street fairs, trying to talk to as many people as possible and just encourage people to come down on Friday.
Absolutely. Do you have any final thoughts or comments for our listeners?
The only thing I would say is come down on Friday. We wear red. Just to show unity and solidarity, and then also bring signs, okay? Bring those protest signs. If you check out our social media, you'll get some ideas. If you don't know quite what to write on one of those signs, we will also have some sign making there if you're not able to bring one. So, you know, bring your friend, bring your neighbor, bring the kids, but just come and raise your voice.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Michelle.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Michelle Daly, an organizer for the Portland Women's Strike. They'll be gathering in Pioneer Courthouse Square on Friday, October 4th at noon. You've been listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Eliza Yurkov. We got more in-depth news coming your way after this.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Zachary Jones-Naray. Since the Israeli assault on Gaza began in October, all independent journalists have been barred from entering the war-torn coastal enclave. Healthcare workers are some of the only independent observers who have been admitted to the territory since October 7th. Feroz Sidhwa is a trauma surgeon who recently returned from Gaza. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg.
You've returned from Gaza, and we've been hearing reports for months and months about how horrible the situation is. Could you describe a little bit of your experience? And of course, you're in the thick of it as a trauma surgeon, so you must have seen probably the worst of it, would you say?
Yes and no. You know, the situation in Gaza is obviously dire. It's horrific. You know, as a trauma surgeon, in the United States, what a trauma surgeon does is they stop people from bleeding to death mostly. And in Gaza, what I actually quickly learned is there were very few such patients that I could take care of, because anybody who actually was at risk of bleeding to death died well before they got to the hospital. The majority of people were injured in explosions, you know, airstrikes, tank, artillery fire, whatever it might be. And their homes were usually collapsed on top of them. So if they had if they had an injury that would lead them to bleed to death over even the course of an hour or two, they would die before anybody could get them out of the rubble. They also had to be injured in a part of the house that would actually be, or the building, depending on what it was, that had to be accessible to the to people digging with their hands, because there was no heavy moving equipment available. So I actually did relatively few hemorrhage control operations. Most of what I did was actually burn and orthopedic care, helping the orthopedic surgeons to stabilize limbs, debriding, meaning removing the dead tissue from large wounds, things like that. And then I did a lot of wound care as well. So taking care of people who had been admitted to the hospital and maybe operated on by another surgeon, but who couldn't, the surgeon couldn't come around and check on their wounds just because there's so many people who'd been injured. So I would check on their wounds, debride them as needed. And, you know, these are war wounds, and war wounds, you know, especially high explosive injuries, tend to develop large necrotic wound bases. And so they need frequent debridement. They need, because if you leave that dead tissue there, it just festers, it gets infected, and the patient will die if it's just left alone. And especially in a patient population that's mostly children, especially a patient population that's largely malnourished, those were the main things.
Were you at one hospital or more?
I was at one hospital. I was at European Hospital. It's on the southeastern edge of Khan Yunis.
Because we've heard that most of the hospitals, if not all, have been pretty much destroyed. Are there some remnants of hospitals?
Yeah. So Gaza has 36 freestanding acute care hospitals. There's four field hospitals as well. But the main bulk of it is the 36 hospitals. Those included Shifa Hospital, which was a 700 something bed medical complex, a huge place. It would have been, if Shifa Hospital was in California, it would be the seventh biggest hospital in the state. So it's a huge place compared to the size of the Gaza Strip, so only 2 million people. That, of course, was destroyed in the course of four raids by the Israelis, finally destroyed on March 29th. The walls have been put back on, and patients can go back inside now, but it's hardly a functional hospital. Shifa was 20% of the hospital beds in Gaza, so you had a hugely outsized impact when that hospital was destroyed. The other hospitals it's hard to keep track of these things, but 25 or 26 of them have been directly attacked and destroyed. But, you know, like European Hospital is kind of a good example. The Israelis don't have to directly attack a hospital to destroy it. So European Hospital, the area around it was forcibly evacuated on July 2nd. The Israelis dropped leaflets, said, you know, get out or we'll kill you. So even though they claimed that the hospital was safe, they claimed to American senators and State Department people that the hospital was safe. They sent the actual staff of the hospital text messages and had a drone flying around the hospital saying leave or die, that kind of thing. So, of course, people left. The patients were evacuated, taken to the other side of Khan Yunis. I'm sure some of them died. I have no idea, honestly. And finally, once the hospital was left, the last three physicians and nurses left as well. Well, the Israelis didn't attack the hospital directly, but after the hospital was empty, the desperate people who stayed in that area looted it so that they could survive. You know, they have to have something to burn so they can cook. They have to have something they can sleep on. If they can find a change of clothes for the first time in 3 months, you know. So even without directly attacking the hospital, Israel is very capable of finding ingenious ways to destroy things. And I shouldn't say Israel, it's the United States and Israel together.
Have you worked in other war zones?
I have, yeah. So I've worked in Zimbabwe, Haiti, Dominican Republic, which is hardly a war zone. And I've worked in Ukraine for 3 times in since the Russian invasion. My work in Ukraine was educational work, teaching trauma care to their physicians, their military and civilian physicians. But yeah, no, I've worked in plenty of other difficult places. Gaza's, and I've worked in the West Bank as well. Gaza's totally, totally unique place.
And you feel that there's not really enough news getting out about it, even though there are a number of doctors and surgeons coming back here to tell their stories. You think that the media is not covering it very well?
Well, I'll give you my own experience. I think probably me and Dr. Mark Perlmutter, we wrote a letter or an article in a magazine called Politico. And since then, I would guess, I don't keep track, but I'm guessing that he and I have probably had more interviews than every other physician and nurse or midwife or anybody else who's been to Gaza combined. That would be my guess. We were on CNN International for maybe 15 minutes or something like that. I was on MSNBC for 5 minutes. And then I've been on programs like yours, of course, you know, Democracy Now!, things like that. So, you know, yeah, I mean, if somebody looks for what do doctors say about Gaza, they can find it. But the way our interviews and all the other ones that I've been able to find of other people as well, the way they're always framed is, what did you see? Oh my God, that's so horrible. Oh, you're such a hero. You know, and it's fine. I mean, yeah, it's nice to hear people say things that make my mom proud. But it doesn't address the question. You know, the reason, you know, so Mark, me, Mark, and some other people put a letter together to the Biden administration. It came out almost 2 months ago now. I think it was July 25th that we released it. It had 45 healthcare worker signatures on it. What we wrote is that we, on a daily basis, all of us saw children shot in the head and chest. And I don't mean like 17 and a half year old, you know, teenagers. I'm talking about young, clearly identifiable as children.
So not bombed.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And that's exactly the point that we were trying to make, is that, look, I don't agree with it, but maybe if a bomb was targeting, you know, Hamas, Pentagon or something, maybe it could hurt a child, and fine, okay, that's not nice, obviously. Nobody wants children to be hurt, but that's not evidence of criminal activity necessarily. But you can't argue the same thing about children getting shot in the head. And I'm not talking about once or twice. I'm talking about literally in the catchment area of every hospital every single day in Gaza. Gaza is a very small place. So you just can't argue that that's accidental. Now, I seriously doubt that, you know, Yoav Gallant or somebody is saying, I want 10 children shot in the head today. That strikes me as unlikely. But it's clearly being tolerated when Israeli soldiers do this. They're clearly doing it deliberately. As Mark put it once, no kid gets shot in the head twice on accident. So they're clearly doing it deliberately. And the Israeli military is not some ragtag militia where they have no idea what their soldiers are doing. They just give them orders and hope they carry them out. You know, they have extremely heavy video surveillance. They all have body cams. I believe, I might be wrong about this, but I believe that most of the sniper scopes actually have video equipment in them as well. They know exactly who they're shooting. There's no confusion about this on their part. So either the Israeli army is ordering its soldiers to shoot children in the head, or it's been tolerating its soldiers shooting children in the head for almost 12 months straight at this point, and there's no difference. It makes absolutely no difference. So when you look at that, you have to start asking, well, okay, if the Israeli army is deliberately shooting children in the head, it's very hard to believe that they're going to any significant that they're taking any significant precautions when they're dropping bombs on people. Those two things don't comport. And furthermore, it just should be kind of obvious. I mean, they're starving the whole population of Gaza. And that's not my opinion. It's the opinion of not just Human Rights Watch and not just Amnesty International. It's the opinion of Senator Van Hollen. It's the opinion of the, you know, 8 or 9 senators who wrote a letter to the Biden administration, I think in January or February. It's the opinion of the World Food Program. It's the opinion of the, you know, you can go on and on. Like, literally everyone who has anything to do with figuring out if people are being starved, say Israel is starving people on purpose. So why would you starve people on purpose but also take extreme measures to protect them from gunfire and bombings? This just doesn't make any sense. This is absurd. for anybody who actually knows the history of how Israel is conducted, it's, again, I keep saying Israel, but that's really not accurate. Anybody who knows the history of how the U.S. and Israel have conducted themselves in Gaza knows full well that there's no, not only are all feasible precautions to protect the civilian population from harm not taken, the civilians are the target of the violence, and that's deliberate. You can, like, you know, we don't have to, like, the fog of war is always difficult, right? But there's plenty of other wars to look at, and the conclusions are very clear. The most heavily studied one is the 2008-09 attack, Operation Cast Lead. The UN Fact-Finding Commission afterwards, what was called the Goldstone Report, it wrote, the conclusion started off with the statement that the Israeli, I'm paraphrasing it, but the Israeli attack on Gaza was an operation meant to punish, humiliate, and terrorize a civilian population and to remove its ability to provide to itself the necessities of life. That's exactly correct. They just realized after October 7th that they could get away with a much larger, much wider scale, and much more severe attack.
And the Israelis rejected that report, saying that...
Well, of course they did. I mean, it's, yeah. This is like, you know, you'll have to forgive me. You're my third interview for today. Sometimes I forget what I've said and what I haven't said already. But, you know, I was talking to a fellow from a Japanese newspaper, and he said, well, how do you respond to what the IDF says, that it's taking all feasible precautions? And I said, you know, I don't understand why anyone cares what the IDF says. First of all, it's uncommon to expect a military that is in the middle of military operations to tell the truth about them. That's not an expectation that literally anyone has of any military anywhere. And it's even more unusual for a military that is systematically engaged in an attack on a civilian population to admit that out loud. Well, why would anybody do that? That's bizarre. Like, that's just utterly bizarre. The only way...
I mean, you do have Israeli politicians saying pretty much that.
Yeah, no, exactly. Like, if you ask the Israeli spokesperson directly, sir, are you deliberately shooting children in the head? Of course they say no. But then you go find other people who say, we ought to shoot all these people in the head. Or what did Smotrich say the other day, that Israel has the right to starve everyone in Gaza to death? And then he said it was in order to get the, I think it was Smotrich, but who knew, one of these people. He said it was okay as long as it's in the service of getting the hostages back, which has to be the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. How, like, do the hostages not need to eat food? I don't understand. Like, it's just completely crazy. You got to remember, Yoav Gallant, who's not some he's not some guy who's far off in the periphery, he's the defense minister. He said on October, I don't know, 7th or 8th, that there would be no food, fuel, water, or electricity permitted to go into Gaza until the war was over. Now, they didn't actually manage to get away with that. They did do that for about 2 weeks straight. Finally, by, I think it was October 24th or 21st, something like that, the Biden administration said, look, you can't just starve everyone in Gaza to death.
Although they've been limiting food.
No, exactly. They're still very much limiting things, and they are still starving everybody, but they weren't allowed to do it in such a ridiculously blatant fashion as just saying, look, everyone's on the clock now, everyone's going to die. They have to do it in a more sophisticated way. They have to do it in such a way that they can be plausibly denied while it's going on. You know, like right now, they've come up with kind of an ingenious mechanism. You know, Israel doesn't just control the outside of Gaza; it physically controls Gaza itself at the moment. And so, when trucks are being brought in through Kerem Shalom, the Israelis are saying, "Look, a truck entered Gaza," and then it's just sitting there; it's not going anywhere. And they're saying, "Oh, well, it's too dangerous to distribute aid." Well, okay, then just because a truck crossed over the fence, I mean, it's not the ground doesn't need to eat; it's the people who are who've all been forcibly forced to the other side of the Gaza Strip near the Mediterranean, or who are scattered throughout the rubble of Khan Yunis and Rafah and Gaza City.
So it's even worse than dropping the food.
Yeah, exactly. And it's even more cynical, which is kind of shocking. But no, it's dastardly. It really is at this point. Then again, I just want to emphasize, I might slip up and say Israel, but everything is the United States and Israel. Israel is doing none of this by itself. Biden and Harris can bluster and claim constantly that they're, we're working tirelessly for a ceasefire. No, you're not. Working tirelessly for a ceasefire is literally one phone call to Benjamin Netanyahu from President Biden saying there will be no more arms until you withdraw from Gaza and negotiate an end to this conflict. That's it. That's all it takes. The President of the United States has absolute authority in such matters. It literally would take 30 seconds.
That's trauma surgeon Feroz Sidhwa, speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. You've been listening to KBU News in Depth. I'm Zachary Jones Murray.
To KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934.